You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Oodles of thanks to Tim and Julie for the past 2 hours, but now at 12 p.m. it's time for Bums on Seats. For the next hour, we'll be casting extra hard stares at the latest cinema releases. Which are worthy of praise, which merely elicit yawns, and which should be mocked mercilessly. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Dave Riley.
Hello.
Steph Smith.
Hello.
Mark Livicic.
Good afternoon.
And Jack Toy.
Ohio.
Ohio. I didn't say shout out states. Okay, today's programme extols the virtues of the unlikeliest heroes and heroines with a brace of new films that find their stories with the outcasts of society. A genetically modified raccoon and a green-skinned assassin are just two of the misfits charged with saving the universe in Marvel Studios' outre space opera blockbuster Guardians of the Galaxy. Still waters run deep in Joe, with Nicolas Cage as the eponymous Mississippi woodsman who's hardly father material but still takes it upon himself to act as protector to a bullied teen. Dwayne Johnson has hands like hams and knees like trees as Hercules, with an old-fashioned swords and sandals romp where the hero may not be all the tales tell. And where the Romain Duris's Parisian playboy finds the course of true love head straight over a cliff in Michel Gondry's Mood Indigo. Plus, we have the first of our previews of the upcoming Cambridge Film Festival, which begins on August the 28th. Among the big-name premieres and revival screenings, the festival offers a rare chance to see four films made from the early German director Gerhard Lambrecht. I spoke to Bryony Dixon from the BFI about the cinema of this nearly forgotten silent cinema master, whose films capture pre-war Berlin in all its complicated and messy glory. That's all to come, but we begin the show in a galaxy far, far away.
So here we are. A thief, two thugs, an assassin, and a maniac. But we're not going to stand by as evil wipes out the galaxy. I guess we're stuck together. Partners.
Are you telling me the fate of 12 billion people is in the hands of these criminals?
Oh, yeah. I look around. You know what I see? Losers. But life's giving us a chance.
To do what?
Something good. Something bad. A bit of both.
Oh, what the hell? I don't got that long a lifespan anyway.
The summer movie schedule is now so jam-packed with superheroes it's tricky to move without treading on a cape or revealing a secret identity. But the studio mandate to always make a character relatable has led to a bunch of sad sack superheroes, more concerned with earthly troubles and their extraordinary powers. There's no fun in punching through walls if you're morally conflicted. Throwing a spanner into this focus group machinery is a new release from Marvel Studios, Guardians of the Galaxy. Based on an obscure comic strip that debuted in the swinging 60s, Guardians is an adaptation that remembers how joyfully stupid and crazy comic books can be. Chris Pratt, a cosily familiar face from American TV in various supporting roles, plays Peter Quinn, an earthling adrift among the planets. Abducted when still a boy, he's now a space pirate with illusions of roguish grandeur. During a spell in prison, he finds himself set of unlikely cohorts. Gamora, a green-skinned assassin played by Zoe Saldana, a tattooed vengeance-hungry madman by the name of Drax, Rocket Raccoon, a genetically modified raccoon voiced by an irascible Bradley Cooper, and his bodyguard Groot, a sentient tree brought to life with the voice of Vin Diesel. Together, the infamous Five put aside their criminal tendencies to try to save a universe threatened by a geocidal warlord by the name of Ronan. Steph, to start with you, Guardians of the Galaxy has been hyped as something different from the rest of the summer, and certainly something different from the usual superhero fare. Does it make good on that promise?
Well, it's certainly different from the usual Marvel output. They've been focusing very strongly on superheroes, either genetically modified or born into the role, and this is an action film in space. It's science fiction. It fits into the same universe as the superheroes, but it's very, very different. There's one other significant difference, and that is fun. I was in a packed cinema crowd watching this last night, and the number of laughs going on was just spectacular. It got the audience going. It gripped everybody, and it had so much more humour than the other Marvel films, and that's something that wasn't lacking in the previous films.
Well, I can think. I mean, Avengers is pretty much almost a comedy action film, isn't it, really? It has that Ghostbusters mould of trying to do both.
It's got some of it. This one has a lot more one-liners. All of the characters have got a funny side. There isn't kind of the straight man and the funny man. They all kind of either intentionally or unintentionally have funny lines in there.
Mark, it's the writer-director of this film, I mean, he shares a co-writing credit, but it's mostly his script, James Gunn. Now, he had his beginnings, his first work was with Troma, his first film, Slither and Super, which is a fine superhero film, a far superior to Kick-Ass and what it's trying to do. They've all been low-budget, almost exploitation films. This was a huge gamble by Marvel Studios, which has it paid off? And has it paid off only because they've managed to smother those tendencies?
I don't think they've managed to completely smother them. There is still a bit of Marvel template going on, but I do think you can feel James Gunn's own sensibilities coming through in this. He's got a very significant, very definitive style. If you've seen Super or Slither, he does pick up a few things like that. Michael Rooker, who's one of his regular actors, pops up in this as well in a significant part. He's got that very offbeat worldview. That Troma sensibility does come through a little bit. There are some very off the wall, some very dark jokes in places. Things a couple of gags I wouldn't have expected to have been able to get into any other Marvel film. He's pushing the boundaries in certain points. The biggest problem for me is that there is a Marvel template, and in two senses it adheres to that too rigidly. The first is that it's another origin story. Apart from possibly Captain America 2 and Iron Man 3, every Marvel movie up to now, even the Avengers, has been an origin story. And we've got another origin story. It would be so great to come to a Marvel movie where we just got the characters and then went straight in, rather than 2 hours more of developing stuff which will then expand. There's a lot of Thanos in here, so this is playing into Avengers 2 and 3. Again, it all feels a building block of a bigger universe. The other problem is that it's yet another Marvel film where people run around for an hour and a half and then have a big space fight, which you can tick off most of the Marvel movies of this genre, and that's also applicable to them. So I'd love to see what's coming in the next phase after the Avengers starting to get away from that mould.
Dave, it's the thing that it does capture from James Gunn's earlier films and from his more eccentric resume which is unusual for a summer film, is it keeps shifting tones. It tries to have that sort of Ghostbusters magic, that lightning in the bottle magic of being both a comedy and an action film and a drama in some ways, and it's 1 minute you're supposed to be laughing or it hopes you're laughing, and the next minute it's sad. Do those shifts in tone work? Because that's very hard to pull off. They can be quite jarring.
I found it worked fantastically well for me. Possibly the only problem was that going straight from humour to solemnity so well was that I was laughing too much from the humour that I missed a bit of the solemnity, and that was actually a trouble throughout the entire film. If you go with a big crowd, you're going to miss some of the jokes because people are still laughing from the last one. But in terms of, you know, tonality shifts, he pulled it together really nicely. Chris Pratt did an excellent job because he's trying to be roguish, charming, Han Solo-esque, and at the same time he's got this troubled past, which does keep, as Mark points out, it does keep popping up because it's kind of his origin story more than anyone else's, I'd say, during the film. You get a little nod to Rocket's origin, where he has one of his mini rants, but, you know, he's just full of mini rants, and I found them all incredibly entertaining.
But it's I suppose, it is maybe the origin. I mean, I didn't mind, because in the end, it's doing what the Avengers did in one film, where the Avengers had six films leading up to that to create all those origins. I think James Gunn did as good a job as he could have done in trying to create these five disparate characters and this incredibly outre galaxy they're going to live in, which
just
is
in
part
one film.
And in one film.
Don't get me wrong, I don't put the blame for that at James Gunn's doorstep. He's done a fantastic job with what he's got in the context of setting this up, and from the sounds of it, he'll get to do Guardians of the Galaxy 2 so in the next phase, so he'll then be able to just take this world on and develop it. I hope that comes to pass. I think it's a Marvel problem rather than specifically a James Gunn problem, but credit to them for hiring him, for taking a bit of a bold step. It is a bold step in the context of the fact that they could just make these films very generic. They could have just churned out, you know, another Hulk movie or a Captain America 3. They will come, but to start to put these in the middle, I'm almost kind of hoping that the end credits show, which I won't spoil here, leads in something as well, because that would genuinely show they're willing to start taking a few risks.
It's Steph, to come back to you, James Gunn has said that he wanted his pitch to Marvel, which he couldn't believe worked, was that it should be weird and wonderful. The film should be as weird and wonderful as possible without knocking the audience, which by which he means obviously the Friday night audience, really, off balance. So he's achieved that.
Well, it certainly didn't knock anybody off balance. I wouldn't say this was a film of any great surprises. And I absolutely loved it. I thought it was great. It got the humour right. But it was cookie cutter. It was a film about just kind of space action and an adventure.
Is it just set dressing, though? Because in the end, it looks fantastic in terms of how everybody's dressed and the spaceships, which are a bit like Chris Foss designs. It's wonderful to see designs like that on the big screen.
Yeah, and the sets are fantastic.
But when you take that down, it's still shot ordinarily. It's still shot like in that Marvel style of being almost TV, not quite. There's nothing really. I don't mean there's no fancy shots or
I
mean, big
I
epic.
I thought the camera work was great. I mean,
all that felt generic to me. In fact, the whole character journeys felt generic. And this is the problem I have with Marvel. When I like them, but I want to like them more because what they're doing is interesting in terms of blockbuster cinema. But I almost never remember anything about the films once I've come out of them. They never create any magic for me.
I think they took a bit of a risk in creating their universe. They put a lot of money in making very big films to establish the continuity and the lines and the characters. I think now they're probably going to sit back for a little bit and just rake it in for a few films before they take the next risk. So I think we're probably going to see a few more of these.
Well, I don't know. Avengers 2, which is the next Marvel in the chain, is apparently even takes some of the lead from the cosmic nature of this film. So I think they're pushing it out further, and if they do make Doctor Strange, is it?
Mm-hmm.
If they do make Doctor Strange in two or three films' time, that's going to be even more comic booky. I'm all for that. I don't quite know what it is it's missing, for me at least. Dave?
Well, there's one thing I wanted to add, which is the unique part of Guardians that none of the other Marvel films have had so far, and that's the amazingness of the soundtrack.
Yes.
That was the one thing about it. All of the other films, they've had decent soundtracks, but this is the first one where it blended in, worked really well. And of course, it gave you some of the best moments in the film, seeing the way it affects this is Chris Pratt's character's life. Because he was a child of the 80s when he's taken from Earth right at the start of the film. And he's never been actually able to escape the 80s. And that also gives the film a unique signature that the other ones, maybe Captain America the First Avenger had it because it was set back during World War II, but the other ones have all been generic time periods. These two at least managed to fashion something unique that way. And that was my point.
Did you think the emotional aspect of it works? Because again, he was very keen, James Gunn, and he said that the link between Star-Lord, between our Peter Quill, our hero, and his late mother, who we see die in the very first scene, in the very first scene, most people are still wandering in at that stage to their allocated seats. The link between Peter Quill and his mother, which carries on through the whole film, that's fairly unusual for a film of spectacle, as he puts it. Did that work? Do you think that emotional link, the fact that every member, it's an origin story of five characters who all need a family.
He does. Peter Quill describes them as losers at one point, in the sense they have all lost something, which is a bit obvious in signposting. But at the same time, you know, you do feel for each of them. You do empathise with each of them to a certain extent. Certainly, a lot more than most of your average blockbusters these days. Certainly more than the other one we'll come on to talk about later. So it works to a point, and I think Marvel in general are proving better at this than a lot of their contemporaries. You know, compare it to the last few DC films, which have been a complete washout in that sense. It's certainly a league above those.
Is it nice to finally see a comic book film embracing its comic book roots unembarrassed? Spider-Man, which they're at Sony, which Sony owns, and is in a complete mess over because the last one made a gazillion dollars, but it made a gazillion dollars less than the gazillion billion dollars the last one made. Mm-hmm. And they keep souping that up with more and more backstory and more emotion. And we've got to the stage now, and it's not just Christopher Nolan's fault. Studios they're run by people who don't read comic books, and they make the characters as little like superheroes as they possibly can. This is a film which they're lucky nobody wears a mask, but and they're not big stars, so they can show their faces. But this at least embraces comic books.
I think it's Marvel starting to get towards its comfort zone. You can't underestimate the achievement. If you think about the three biggest franchises they had, they were all with other studios. Spider-Man, Fantastic Four and X-Men were all got sold before they got into the movie-making business. They have made a multi-billion dollar franchise out of characters that possibly, apart from Captain America, no one would have heard of 5 years ago. I don't think anyone would have heard of Guardians of the Galaxy until the film was announced.
Mm, yes.
Pretty much. And it's already been a roaring success in the States. Looks like it will be here as well. They're obviously hitting a chord with the audience. And if they can, you know, be comfortable in that skin, if they can truly embrace what's made their comic books a success and bring that to the screen, good luck to them.
Okay, all right, we'll wrap up with Guardians of the Galaxy opened yesterday, or Thursday rather, and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A, and as always with anything with a huge budget which has to be recouped, it is available to see in both 2D and 3D. Always one to madly fidget in his director's chair, it's impossible to second guess what director David Gordon Green will turn his attention to next. As soon as his lyrical first films, George Washington and All the Real Girls, had him dubbed as the new Terrence Malick, which is always a lazy shorthand anyway, he dived into the bawdy comedy of Pineapple Express and The Sitter, only to then move from stoner humour to prestige car commercials, starring a frowning Clint Eastwood, which screened during last year's Super Bowl. Last year, he released Prince Avalanche, a tale of road workers as modern milquetoast cowboys, really, and his latest movie, Joe, takes him further into the fringes of American society. Based on the book by Larry Brown, Joe is a backwards horror where the terror is the quicksand of a life impossible to escape. Nicolas Cage, in a non-operatic frame of mind, plays Joe Ransom, a decent man whose easy tendency for violence has seen him in and out of prison. He hides his temper in a Mississippi shantytown, leading a ragtag crew employed to poison healthy trees to make way for profitable forests. He hires a young teenage drifter, a hard worker with a home life bedeviled by an alcoholic father. Recognising that the boy could easily slip into the same mess that he himself is sinking into, he begins to see himself as the boy's protector.
Hey, mister.
Yeah?
Me and my daddy just got into town. I was wondering if you'd give us a job.
I pay a day's pay for a day's work. And if we work till dinner and get rained out, I pay for the whole day. Does that sound fair enough?
Yes, sir.
I'm Joe. When I watch that boy, I see someone who's nothing like me.
The hell you looking at?
Why do you stick around like this?
What's most important right now is me taking care of Dorothy and Mama. We kind of got a family problem right now.
What happened?
He's all beat up.
I can't get my hands dirty in every little thing. You know how I get.
Why you want to go back to the damn penitentiary, man?
Freeze, Joe!
Bring your mom and your sister. You'll be safe here.
Mark, the reviews for Joe have understandably so focused on Nicolas Cage's performance, so I suppose we should start there. How well does the actor mesh his usual, as I mentioned earlier, operatic style, his over-the-top style that he explores knowingly, with David Gordon Green's more naturalistic style of filming? They don't seem compatible at first glance.
They don't. I think there's two things at work here, because there's a whole number of people within this film who are not actors, they're real life people. It was in Prince Avalanche, there was one person who they came across while filming out in the wilds whose house had burned down, and he incorporated them into the script. This is the sort of aliens to that film's Alien, of taking this to a massive extent of half the cast is non-professional. For me, Nicolas Cage blended very well with the other actors in the film. I was taken out of it slightly by the sheer number of people who clearly weren't professional actors. In that never quite felt to me as if it, those two worlds gelled as effectively as it did in Prince Avalanche. That said, it still does create a convincing milieu. It feels like it could be round the corner from Prince Avalanche, and it's a world I wanted to explore more of. It's a much deeper, darker side of that world. I think because the film is front-loaded with some of those contextual scenes, it takes a while to get going, to get anywhere. Once it does, then it's a great success.
I like the fact that you never quite knew where it was going. I mean, I like David Gordon Green's work. I like Pineapple Express as much as I like All the Real Girls. I like the fact that his camera's not lazy, but it takes its time. And the fact that when they introduce the poisoning the trees sequence, it goes on for quite some time. And it goes into quite some detail. I also like, and I'll come to you on with this, Jack, that it's as Mark says, a lot of the characters, with the exception of Nicolas Cage and Ty Sheridan as the teenager he takes under his wing, who everybody's familiar with from Mud and Terrence Malick's last film, Tree of Life, not his last film, Tree of Life. With the exception of those two, everybody just about is naturalistic, including the drunk father who was a drifter they came across and auditioned for the part, who's since died, the actor.
Bad that I thought Gary Poulter, that actor, was Bruce Dern from Nebraska at first. Like, God, he's really roughed up since that one. But no, he was just a... I don't even know if he was a jobbing actor, was he?
He was a drifter that they... A sort of drifter homeless man that they found and auditioned, and he nailed the audition and he was right. And then two months after they finished filming, he drank himself to death. So he was mirroring, you know, but away from that, I like the fact it wasn't judgmental about any of these characters. It could so easily have been, this is a dreadful life, because from the outside it is a dreadful life these people lead. It's not like Prince Avalanche, when they're college graduates who are slumming it by painting roads and being amongst the Southern life. Here, these are the people who can't escape this. This is the only life they know. And then sometimes when they're speaking, even though you know it's English, you can't understand a single word. It's all that the vernacular is so thick, but it never judges them. I like that a great deal.
Yeah, it added an air of authenticity. If Gary, I didn't realise at
Poulter.
First, Gary Poulter,
yeah.
If he was a real-life drifter, in that scene where he's clubbing the other drifter to death with this wrench, I think because there's violence in the film, but there's not that explicit level of bloody violence in other scenes, I was quite shocked by it, and I was thinking, oh, is he acting, or is he drawing from past experiences here? But equally, like Nicolas Cage, do you think, I know he has a habit of going bankrupt and then doing not so good films, did you find his performance believable as like a kind of rough, kind of poor guy, when in reality he's probably going back to his West Coast mansion and living up with the Coppolas?
I think he lives in the West Country now, doesn't he? Lives down in Bath, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, which is... I think
he has 47 homes. Okay. I didn't see anything unusual about Nicolas Cage. I liked it a great deal, but I thought it was everybody saying, oh, he's back to form. Did nobody see Bad Lieutenant? And I feel like he was playing a similar character, Bad Lieutenant. One of the internet journalists very cleverly pointed out with Bad Lieutenant that Nicolas Cage agreed, it was in an interview, that he was basically playing a universal movie's monster. He's playing Frankenstein in Bad Lieutenant. He's playing Frankenstein's monster. He's playing a misunderstood monster. It's the same here, even down to the fact that at the end of the film, in the finale, he's limping. He's limping as the villagers almost, and if you see the police that constantly hound him, as the villagers waving their pitchforks, I thought it was well within his comfort zone.
Mm. I thought it was a very different kind of monster, though. If you look at Bad Lieutenant, he's kind of... He is very, very loud with his insanity. He dominates the film. It's a very extreme performance. Whereas this was much quieter. He was there were moments of noise, but he was trying to contain himself all the way through. He was trying to to hold himself as a character, trying to hold himself back and trying to control himself, which is something that didn't really happen in Bad Lieutenant or in many of Nicolas Cage's performances. He tends to actually ham it up.
I thought he was hamming it up a little bit here in a way I enjoyed. I never have a problem with hamming it up in a film like Knowing. I don't know why he has to be...
Most of his best performances are when he's really out there, and I thought this was not quiet, but a lot quieter. I mean, I don't disagree with you about the monster thing. I think, yes, you're right with the whole villagers and pitchforks, but I thought it's a different kind of monster.
We know he's capable of this kind of role. Leaving Las Vegas is a prime example of a role where he didn't showboat or anything like that and was a fantastic performance. And, you know, we know he's capable of this. I think he's proven again he's capable of this kind of role. I think it almost comes down to the fact you can tell not whether he cares or whether he's just turned up for the paycheck. And increasingly these days he's being forced to turn up for the paycheck. I hope this will mean that more directors remember how good he is and start to offer him these kind of roles again, rather than just thinking they can put him in the middle of a blockbuster poster and then just wait for the cash to roll in, which invariably doesn't, because he doesn't care.
So maybe that quote on the poster is more to do with the pitch of the film, and maybe the studio thinks, oh, he may have been great in Werner Herzog's Bad Lieutenant, but that was a Werner Herzog film, and we're going to pitch this as a more mainstream film for those that won't go and see a Werner Herzog film. Perhaps.
Yes, I think so. I think the Bad Lieutenant. He's done other good performances. It's not just simply Leaving Las Vegas. And I have no problem with his broader performances. And in fact, as Mark said, it's not the performances themselves. It's the films he decides to take on, yeah. which seems peculiar, but. You know, it doesn't seem fair to judge him either. It's his own career. We're not forced to watch these things.
Again, you know, you can see when he cares about a big performance, something like Face Off, where he's completely over the top the entire first 20 minutes. Then the rest of the film, he has to play the subdued character, and he does both very effectively. You know, he can switch, but you can tell when he's invested in a film and when he's invested in what the director's looking to get from him. And I think him and David Gordon Green were a good match this time.
Do you think, Steph, what's your opinion on the use of the non-professional actors? Not just Gary Poulter, but the scene where they're looking for the missing dog, called Dog. He's Nicolas Cage's cat, Joe's dog. When everybody they happen across, especially in the scene with the lady on the bicycle, the African-American lady on the bicycle, where he keeps trying to give her his number, and you realise that it's just somebody they saw on the street, and they stopped, and he's almost being Nicolas Cage in that scene. And was it too distracting, or did it lend an air of slight... There was a strangeness that David Gordon Green was afterwards, after, by having his movie star surrounded by authentic voices and faces. It was supposed to be slightly distancing, I believe.
I'm one of these people that I don't much care about the method, I care about the output. And
well, did it work as output, or was it distracting?
Absolutely. I wasn't spending time sitting there going, spot the actor. I was engaged with the film. And I was very surprised to find out. I can't remember the guy's name. Was Poulter?
Gary Poulter was the father.
I was very surprised to find out he wasn't a professional actor. I thought the range of performance that David Gordon Green got from him was phenomenal. Because it wasn't just, we're going to put you in a situation and let you react to it. He actually had to drive a scene. And he had to set the tone of the scene and dominate it. And he did that phenomenally well. I think what we have there is a wonderfully gifted natural actor who was untrained, rather than somebody who you grab off the street and you go, well, let's let you play you and see how that works in the film. I thought he actually had a role, and he nailed it.
Maybe acting is not that hard.
I've tried it. It is. I can't do it.
maybe the big stars are just selling it is difficult. Maybe that's why they go on about doing their own stunts all the time, because they have to dress it up, because actually the acting bit's easy. I don't know.
Was it? Show me pain, now smile. Now
oh, that
smile
was brilliant.
On top of show
yes,
me pain.
The scene in the disused boatyard where he's describing how to look cool. Yeah, there was lots of, as usual with David Gordon Green films, there were lots of individual scenes. I liked the film as a whole, and I thought it was an interesting companion piece too. Prince Avalanche.
The one scene which did bum me is the one that Jack mentioned earlier, which is where Gary Poulter attacks a homeless man. Because it feels the same way that there's a scene with Dennis Hopper in Speed, which is the same. It's a scene with violence. It's the most violent scene that character commits. No one else is party to that scene. It has no consequence in the rest of the film. So it is purely for our benefit as an audience, and that felt to me like it could have been more integrated with the plot. That's probably the only...
I like the fact... we've got to wrap this up, but I like the fact there were no repercussions of this one act. Unless you count the very ending, perhaps.
Yes.
As possibly something, another weight on his conscience with the possible suspicions we have of child abuse and that things that might have driven him to being this the drunken monster that he is.
I suppose maybe I'd like to see two scenes like that rather than one, it wouldn't have felt quite so jarring. Maybe there's different ways it could have been handled. That's just the one thing that stuck out for me. But yeah, I shouldn't complain because the rest of it was fantastic. Must mention Ty Sheridan as well. He was great. It's well worth a watch.
I'm getting ready to see Ty Sheridan in a film in which he doesn't play a kind of teenager from the southern states in a bit of a hick family looking for a father figure. I think he's shown he can do that really well, and so I want to see him moving into something else.
He's only two roles away from landing his first superhero, I would have thought. Yeah. That's the way it works. Anyway, okay. Joe opened last week in his screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. The 34th Cambridge Film Festival is almost upon us. On August the 28th, 10 days of film premieres, film revivals, film restorations and film rarities will fill the three screens of the Arts Picture House, as well as widely across Cambridge. As always, there'll be short film showcases, films screened in the open air of Grantchester's Meadows, visiting filmmakers to chat to in the bar, and of course the chance to see the best in current world cinema. Our first festival preview throws a little light on the rare chance to see four of the most important films by early German director Gerhard Lambrecht, an almost forgotten figure whose career spanned German silence all the way up to the post-war masterpiece Somewhere in Berlin. Lambrecht was the quintessential Berlin director, and his fascination for the city is perfectly represented in the four films, dating from 1925 to 1928, the festival is screening. In The Slums of Berlin, Children of No Importance, People to Each Other, and Under the Lantern captured the city just during the years of the Weimar Republic, when the rich lived well and the rest suffered with increasing poverty and discontent. To get a better picture of this still fairly unknown filmmaker, I spoke to Bryony Dixon, co-director of the Silent Film Festival, curator of silent cinema at the BFI, and author of a new essay on Lambrecht that is being published in the latest Sight and Sound. I asked Bryony about where Lambrecht's work fitted in the German cinema history and how he innovated by shooting on the street rather than in the studio, as it was more the norm at the time. But I began by asking her if it was wrong to judge the four film screening as simply hard-hitting examples of social realism.
All four of these films are little masterworks in their own right, and they have similar subject matters in that they're all dealing with particular, what they call the milieu of Berlin, the sort of poorer parts of Berlin. And the four films deal with different types of people. It does sound almost as though this is a sort of bit of a grim up north kind of set of films, but that's not the experience of viewing them at all. What you get from viewing these is, number one, they are extremely well-made films. They're little masterpieces, and they're about important subjects. These are grown-up films. This is not escapism. These are proper grown-up films which will tell you something important about human beings, about, you know, the human condition, and also about Germany at that time.
Would you be able to say a little bit about his directorial style? There's a bundle of reviews of the recent re-releases, the same films Cambridge is showing, and elegant realism is a phrase that keeps coming up. Is that a good summation of his style? Because, again, reading reviews at the time, he seems to have drawn fire by showing the changing face of Germany but not commenting upon it.
Yes, that's right. The phrase elegant realism is absolutely bang on the money. He's not a revolutionary or a political activist in any sense, although he's making films on these subjects. And his filmmaking style that he likes to do is to shoot with a high degree of realism, lots of exteriors, very, very good studio work, and a very pared-back style, I think, which is, and he's a very good practitioner of this.
You mentioned directors there that were innovators. Was he an innovator of that sort, or was he more of a studio hand with a certain style?
Probably not in technical terms an innovator, but he understood profoundly his art and craft. I think where he's more innovative is in the subject matters that he picks. So the types of dramas that he chooses to make about working class Berlin characters, social problems, extremes of poverty and, you know, this sort of inescapable poverty that was very much the concern in Germany, in Berlin in particular at that time. So he's just saying, this is the situation. Understand why these people do what they do and try and help in small ways.
What effect did these did these films have at the time? I mean, in the end, were they just seen by the chattering classes and they had no effect in the way that sometimes Ken Loach films do now? They're seen by the wrong people in order to get the message across.
No, I think that is exactly right. He's slightly preaching to the converted, and that is, of course, exactly what happened. The more revolutionary films like Mother Krause's Trip to Happiness get more attention because they're more outrageous, if you like, and they're sort of actual propaganda sort of for political parties, whereas Lamprecht's are not. They probably did a certain amount to raise awareness of social problems, but they were most likely, and they were popular, they were very, very popular and made a lot of money for him and the studios. But I do definitely get the sense that they were seen primarily by, you know, probably the people who would have had more sympathy with those people and situations anyway. Very like the Ken Loach situation.
How important, because obviously with the films that are showing at the festival only covered from 1925 to 1928, which seems to be the core of his very best work of this style, but he kept making films up until the mid-50s. How important, and through the war, how important is his body of work as a barometer of German history, early, you know, the first half of the last century, really?
Lamprecht is a very good example of a barometer of German history in film. He comes slightly after German Expressionism, so he doesn't do that. But he takes German cinema in the direction that it's going to go with this sort of social realism type of film. And unlike many of his contemporaries, he doesn't leave. When the Nazis come in, he keeps his head down, carries on working, and does safe, uncontroversial films until after the war, when then he picks up again with his sort of more social condition dramas. So he just lies low during that period. And I don't think there's any sense that anyone has ever accused him of being a kind of collaborator with Nazism in any way, which is to his credit that people thought he had that kind of integrity to just carry on. The thing that's most important to understand about Lamprecht is he is a Berliner to his core. This is his home. This is everything that he's interested in and concerned with. All his great films are about Berlin, and they're pretty timeless. I mean, these issues are just as important today. And many of them do have hopeful endings. You know, there is always some kind of hope at the end that this is something, a situation about which we can do something.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Bryony Dixon for finding the time during a very busy week to speak to me, and to Pam Hutchison at Silent London for putting me in contact with her. As mentioned, the Cambridge Film Festival begins on the 28th of August and screens all day, every day, until the 7th of September. The main programme will be released next week, with the digital copy becoming available on Monday, we hope. Remember to check for updates on everything Cambridge Film Festival focused on www.cambridgefilmfestival.org.uk. I've been informed that the four Gerhard Lamprecht films will be enjoying two screenings each, once at the Arts Picture House and then again at a showing at Emmanuel College. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Dave Riley, Steph Smith, Mark Livesich, and Jack Toy.
The day is still just starting here on Cambridge 105. It's the last summer Saturday of the season following on after us at 1 o'clock, and they're reporting from the Alzheimer's Race Day at Newmarket Races. Following on from that from 4 to 5 is Bookmark, which today has Rowan Pelling talking about erotic fiction. Erotica is followed by The Language of Love at 5 with Radio Dante, everything Italian in Cambridge. We've still got another, just around about 20 minutes yet to go. We'll wrap up the show with a review of Michel Gondry's Mood Indigo, but before that, we're busy printing the legend.
No matter how fast you run, no matter how far you go, the beast will follow. Man cannot escape his fate. Hercules.
Your name is a rallying cry.
Do we die in this battle?
My time's not come yet. Not sure about yours.
We will fight for you. And we will die for you.
Have faith in yourself. Now, tell me. Who are you?
I am Hercules!
There's a neat order in the story of Hercules moving from its original oral tradition to the status of poetic myth, then becoming an heroic bedtime story, a Disney song and dance spectacular, a blood and thunder comic book, and now a film laced with CGI and moral messages. It's a multimedia Chinese Whispers. This latest Hercules, which opened at cinemas across the land last week, is a retelling dripping in special effects and battles, but also surprisingly aware of its place in the lexicon. Dwayne Johnson, he's long since dropped his World WWF moniker of The Rock, plays the eponymous Greek hero, a legend in his own lifetime, a man whose seemingly impossible deeds dare speak of a lineage with the gods themselves. But legends are all they are. Hercules is a family man who tells tall tales to put fear into the hearts of his enemies and raise his asking price as a mercenary. But the problem with selling your sword to the highest bidder is you never truly know who you are fighting for. Dave, Hercules, the trailer promised ham-fisted action and no-holds-barred campery, really. Does it deliver on those two fronts?
In terms of the trailer, it might not deliver everything you expect. One of the main problems, I guess you would say, with it is actually Dwayne Johnson himself taking it just a bit too seriously when everyone else around him is determined to have a bit more fun. John Hurt's also a bit too serious as the king. Joseph Fiennes, I don't know what he was doing. But the highlight of it for me was Ian McShane and Rufus Sewell just having a giggle, basically. Turn up on set, say a few silly lines, throw some knives at people, run away again. And every time they're in the film, it picks up, it lightens it for the audience, but then it goes back and it's a little bit dour. The action sequences were impressive. I know you like them more than other action sequences.
I thought they were better directed, than the action scenes. I could follow them more. They were more interesting than the action scenes in Guardians
kind
of the Galaxy.
Proper battles almost, because they didn't have lasers.
I like anything where I can understand tactics, pretty much.
Including throwing horses?
Yes, well, anyway, one scene. what you're describing there, I'll come to you, Steph, is that the title says Hercules, he's Dwayne Johnson's high-powered physique is across the poster, but this is more like Kelly's Heroes. This is deliberately an ensemble piece, really. Rufus Sewell, and he's got this group of cohorts, which almost quite nicely, because they're all given something to do, but they're almost as prominent as he is, really.
They are, and I think that is part of the problem. It is Hercules. It should be about him, and if anything, I felt I didn't have that much of an idea of who he was. To me, Hercules has got to be a film about a hero. It's got to be a man who's motivated by something. Not greed, it's got to be some force for good. And nothing in the first half of the film demonstrated that. He was a mercenary. He was out to make money. It's only when he starts getting moral qualms about where the money's coming from about two-thirds of the way through the film.
Well, we know we have an awkwardly placed flashback which tells us that his family was killed.
Yes, we do. I would have loved to have seen that. And the original quests that he had to undertake were done in such a laughably short montage.
Well, because they're lies. The 12 labours of Hercules, which we see the ones that involve the biggest special effects, they're the ones that dominate the trailer. They're the first 4 minutes of the film. And they're a story being told by his official storyteller who helps
put fear into the heart of his enemies. He never does. Yeah. That's fine. I don't mind that. I quite like that. Well, and that's what the original Steve Moore's original graphic novel did. But here, at the end, he's a superhero again. So what you know?
I'm fine discarding those scenes, but you've got to substitute something else in that establishes his character. You've got to actually see something about the man, and I don't think we did.
So they were just relying on a normal game performance from Dwayne Johnson. He gets to flash that famous smile of his. He's always watchable. He's fine.
That was fine. It came down to if the action scenes are going to happen, they're going to be big and I'm going to be rooting for him, I need something to root for. I need to have an idea of the character. And I don't think this is the flaw in the performance. I think this is the flaw in the writing. I think they needed something to establish his motivation. And I don't think they got it. I think they missed out on that.
Dave, I'm always left wondering with these films who exactly they're aimed at. It's not like there was a golden age of heroic epics. Even the Ray Harryhausen films, once you take out the Ray Harryhausen effects, which are obviously still gobsmacking, they're poor films. It's classed with bland leads and with romantic interest that doesn't get to do anything but fall over their own shoes and be damsels in distress. They're not very good films. So they haven't really, there isn't a tradition that this is departing from. But I don't know who the audience is really for this, because there's swearing in it, so it's not really for young children. It's quite violent.
It's probably the 300 crowd.
But then it doesn't look like 300. It's filmed by Dante Spinetti. So it looks, actually looks quite fantastic in places. But and it looks like a real film set on a real.
I didn't like most of the CGI in Hercules. I thought it looked a bit ropey.
But then it's supposed to, because it's part of
again,
it's not real.
I did like the reveal of what the Hydra actually was. You get a little flashback to him coming back victorious after slaying the Hydra. And can I spoil it or not? I'm not going to spoil it.
Well, no. Everything fantastical in the myth in this film has everything fantastical is real.
I thought they did that one. But then, at the end of it, they kind of reversed it again, because did you watch the credit sequence carefully?
No.
Animated credit sequences, and they retell the three legends that it covers again, showing how he actually did it, or would have done it, if the creatures were in fact real, but not by himself, with his team. So it's got the slaying of the Nemean lion, and it's not just him. He delivers the killing blow, but Ian McShane's run underneath and stabbed it already, and someone else is dancing around distracting this lion that's just trying to get a decent night's kip, I reckon.
So that's
kind of like they've put a third retelling just in two minutes of credit sequence.
I quite enjoyed that aspect of it. That's why I said it was aware of its lexicon. It's aware that it's another retelling of a retelling of a retelling of a retelling. I sort of enjoyed that.
One in for good measure.
I sort of enjoyed that.
It's just a silly, fun movie in the end, I think. So.
Okay, when it comes to a reviewer actually winding me up and saying end now, I don't know, it's just, I suppose I should. Anyway, okay. Hercules opened last weekend and is showing at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. You're getting too big for your boots, Mark. I just want to talk about Gondry. Okay. It's been, all right, we've got another 10 minutes. It's been nigh on impossible for visionary French director Michel Gondry to escape the shackles of his 2004 masterpiece Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. His following films, The Science of Sleep, Be Kind, Rewind, even the Hollywood paycheck for The Green Hornet, they haven't lacked Gondry's astonishing style and craft, but these visuals seem a trifle twee when divorced from Charlie Kaufman's sharp scripting. New release Mood Indigo would seem to play to Gondry's strength. It's adapted from Boris Vian's famous novel of an absurdist romance between fashionable ciphers. Romain Duris plays Colin, a well-to-do playboy inventor who lives a Parisian life of flirtation and philosophy. His world is a Gondry dream. His house is home to 1,000 brilliant visual gags, his daily routine a choreography of magical props and staggering sleight of hand. This world of colour and action explode 100-fold when he meets the beautiful Chloe, played by Audrey Tautou. They fall head over heels in love, and when the unfortunate harsh reality of life pricks their fever dream existence, they both find it a bit difficult to cope. No trailer for this, Jack. It's Mood Indigo, so I'll come straight to you. The marketing for this film highlight the crazy, the sort of cosily inventive papier-mâché aspect of Michel Gondry's work. But does that constant inventiveness that fills the 95 minutes of the film, or 117 minutes of the film, get in the way of the tale's heartbreak?
I don't think so. I think it complements it, and it's evidenced in the... there's two different posters for the film. If you live in America, where Drafthouse have picked up the film, the poster is Romain and Audrey sitting in a very colourful, kind of pastel flower bed, and it looks very happy. And then Studio Canal in the UK, they've chosen to go with the underwater kissing scene, which in the film, in the context of the film, is still quite upbeat and uplifting, but the poster looks a bit kind of gloomy and melancholy, and I think if it weren't for these creative flounces, then I'd have been far more depressed by the end of it.
The last 20 minutes is particularly bleak. Mark, you have problems.
As a general statement, yes, I can't argue that.
I'm getting back at you winding me up. Come on.
Yes. I think if you're not prepared for the last 20 minutes, I mean, I haven't read Boris Vian's original text, which I understand is quite civilized. It does appear from the Wikipedia synopsis to be very faithful to that
it's
text.
It's faithful in story and tone.
Yes, certainly in the content. The last 20 minutes is incredibly bleak. When I came out last night from seeing it, the audience had the general air of people who'd just been sitting through 2 hours of watching puppies being shot, which is remarkable for a film which brought me more joy than pretty much anything this year except Grand Budapest Hotel. But those moments of joy are self-contained and they don't quite gel with that melancholy at the end. It feels like someone's just got a melancholy lever and just pushed it to full over the last 20 minutes rather than it being a natural movement. I mean, it is so much wit and invention, it's great. There's one sequence that lasts maybe 3 or 4 minutes in the middle of the film where they're actually getting married, Romain Duris and Audrey Tautou. And within the first minute of that, you get stop motion with live characters, you get back projection, there's a sort of M.C. Escher feeling, there's a priest who arrives on a space shuttle. It's absolutely mad in a good way. It's almost too much. Not for me, but there will be for a lot of people, I think. But ultimately, you look at films like Grand Budapest, you look at films like Gondry's Own Until Sunshine the Spotless Mind, and he got into the characters of Joel and Clementine there. I never feel into the characters of any of the characters here.
Is it the problem because they are ciphers? They're ciphers in the novel, and they're deliberately ciphers, and that here it is difficult. They could have fallen in love with anybody, he says in the film. Then Colin says, I could have loved the other major female character. I could have loved you just as much as I've loved Chloe, you know, and they're almost deliberately interchangeable, and that does hinder it when it's aiming for this heartbreak of the end.
Well,
it's
briefly suggested that towards the end he does he have a bit of a romantic liaison with his friend?
It's suggested, though, you don't know if it's Audrey Tautou's imagination, but I think that suggests the fact that they could have easily done that. She says, if I hadn't met, you know, your friend, I would have been happy with you.
I just wonder if it's the cut that we saw, because we've all agreed before coming into the studio that we don't remember at the end of the film seeing Colin drowning, yet the reviews in Little White Lies and Sight and Sound say it finishes with him drowning.
This is the cut that Gondry prefers, so however this ends, this is the only cut we should discuss. Like this is the longer cut is before he finessed the film.
Okay.
So there's nothing left out that makes more sense that Gondry wanted in. I think in the end he does struggle. He struggled with all of his films, with the exception of Eternal Sunshine, which is one of the 3 or 4 best films of the last 2 decades. Of romantic films, he does struggle with character. He wants the visuals, and he said the visuals should have, these staggering visuals should mean something. They're not just prettiness or inventiveness, but I'm not quite sure he always achieves that.
It's an odd one. I hadn't realised until I looked back at his resume that he made The Green Hornet, the Seth Rogen remake, which actually is very good on character and doesn't have much of his usual inventiveness.
And it's written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. It's not written by Gondry.
It feels like somebody took the two senses of his beautiful artistic sensibility of seeing things in that different way and melding out the character and just has taken them out and put them in two entirely different films. It's, you know, the two feel almost the two sides of the same coin that Eternal Sunshine was. Don't get me wrong, I loved individual moments of this film, but absolutely adored them.
Is that the problem? Is it still this pop video sensibility? His pop videos, which is where he made his name before Eternal Sunshine, are almost always breathtakingly brilliant, and the only pop videos I really like. There are sequences in this, the rain and storm during the picnic, for instance, which are sequences. They're brilliant sequences, but they have no bearing on anything else. Is that still a problem here? Is that really episodic?
I think it's foreshadowing the next scene where Colin chucks the shoe through the window, and then that's what leads.
That's
to
true.
The water,
yes, that is true. But then you don't need to deliver it. You don't need to serve the scene in that way. He always goes for the most inventive way to solve the scene. It does need to be there. It's not empty artifice.
Well, it has the most accidental laughter scene in any film I've seen this year, right near the end of the film when it cuts to, like, oh, she will have to have a pauper's funeral, and then it cuts to the coffin just getting chucked out the window, and all of us on the front row burst out in laughter yesterday, but and the rest of the audience was silent.
So I know. I laugh. But there is as I think as a final point, I think it is bleak and it is melancholic, but it's the same bleakness and melancholy that was in Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and in The Science of Sleep, which is another film which cripples itself with sadness and undercuts the papier-mâché with melancholia. I think it's part of a piece of...
Don't get me wrong, it's a step up from Be Kind Rewind, which was just full of really unlikable, almost loathsome characters. These are just non-entities as people. They are people in service of Gondry's next great idea, and they're great ideas, but sadly they get underserved by being stuck to whatever Gondry wants to put on screen next.
Shout out to Omar Sy as well. He's awesome in the film, and he's next going to be seen in Jurassic World.
Is he? Yep. Oh, that's a shame. No, I'm nothing against that. Nothing against that. You just wonder what point of the film will be eaten.
To bring us full circle, as is Chris Pratt, of course. So it's it should be an
interesting leads back to dinosaurs. Of course it does. Why did I ever doubt that? Okay. Mood Indigo opened yesterday, August the 1st, and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate, what is it, Jack? 15 for mild nudity, I think, isn't it? It says on the poster. And that is what we have time for on the show this afternoon. As ever, the whole shebang we polished and released as Cambridge 105 podcast in the next few days, available from either the Cambridge 105 website or our page on iTunes. We'll be back on August the 16th, our last show before the Manic broadcast of the Cambridge Film Festival. I'm sure we'll have another festival preview, as well as reviews of two fascinating sophomore films from promising directors, Animal Kingdom directors returning with an apocalyptic drama called The Rover, whilst Walt with Bashir's director, Ari Folman, mixes live action with animation in the surreal The Congress. Plus, we should have God's Pocket, featuring one of the final performances from Philip Seymour Hoffman. We'll wrap up the show with some Duke Ellington, whose songs form the romantic Greek chorus to the romance of Mood Indigo. Please stay tuned for Saturday, Sunday, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.